Well, hey, good morning, everyone. We're starting this morning a new sermon series, and so you're going to want to get a hold of some sermon notes. If you are watching this on the church website, you see a little QR code that, if you've got a phone handy, it'll bring up the sermon notes that way and some other resources as well. If you've got the sermon, the YouVersion app on your phone, you can search for our church. You'll find the sermon notes and all the scripture passages that way and can follow along with us. Starting a new summer series this morning on the Bible's record of the epic life story of Joseph. And as you see there, I captioned it, A Man of Faith and Forgiveness, because those are two huge themes that flow from Joseph's life. And they are also, let's be honest, two of the most challenging things for any of us to do, isn't it? You know, it's really hard to trust God when we don't quite feel like we are going through things that we can trust Him with. And it is just so, so difficult to be a person of forgiveness. Chuck Swindoll included Joseph in his Great Lives from God's Word series. And on the opening page, he has this little blurb. Chuck was in the Marine Corps, and so he shared this slogan from those days. He said, "To err is human, to forgive is divine, neither is Marine Corps policy." Now, I chuckled at that when I first read it, having had similar experiences in my military days, but I also realized that that is kind of not human policy either, isn't it? We especially don't like to forgive others when they make mistakes. We don't like make mistakes on our own. We have a tough time owning them when we do, but it's really, really hard to forgive others. It's really not human policy. Now, we expect God to be like that. That is the divine part of that little slogan that we sure struggle with doing that and making that a practice for ourselves. And Joseph's story boldly challenges that default position, because here is a man who experienced incredible betrayal and hardship, and yet through it all demonstrated that he was committed to trusting God as a man of faith and to forgive others, even when that seemed enormously undeserved. There's an awful lot to learn from Joseph's life, and we're going to just slowly walk through this as we go through the summer months. But like with any story, today I want to start at the beginning. Now, I share a little illustration as I get started. This past weekend, my mom and stepdad came for a visit for the weekend. In the process, they brought a tote of stuff from my growing up years, a lot of old photos that have been placed into photo albums now, and quite frankly, a lot of pictures that I don't ever really remember seeing before of my youngest of years. I stuck one picture up here just so you know, see how cute of a kid I was way back in those days. But a lot of great memories, and I look forward to taking a little bit of time and wading through some of that in the months ahead. But one of the things that I discovered in the flap of one of the first books was a stack of 5x8 cards, four pages that were stapled together, that list every significant sickness, injury, and vaccine shot I had as a child, all the way up to when I left for college in 1982. Everything is documented in there. Everything is written down. Four pages of every single thing. Now, some of those things I've been told about, and some of those I still know the scars from, detailed injuries. For instance, I have a scar on my wrist when I burned myself as a child, knew that, and I've heard the story many times from my mom about how I gashed a 1-inch hole in my forehead on the rocking horse at home. It turns out, by looking at that card and comparing the dates, both those happened when I was a 2-year-old. So I guess I lived up to the label of the terrible twos. But also documented in there when I stepped on a rusty nail in the backyard at 7 and when I broke a finger at age 11. It all got written down. It all got recorded for future reference. And it's interesting to look back and read that now. But you know, thankfully, not everything that I did as a kid got recorded, because we all go through a bunch of things, whether it's things we do, whether it's things that happen to us or around us. And a lot of it's kind of messy. And yet, I look back in my own life, and I think you could probably do this too, that every one of those things shaped me, and they shape us, they affect us, who we become. And Joseph was no different than that. Joseph experienced some very messy early years, and so that's what I call today's sermon, those messy early years. And tonight I want to just look at the opening pieces to his story, and to do that in four parts. And so if you've got those sermon notes, here's the parts. The first one I just labeled childhood trauma. Everybody probably could put that down as some of the opening pages of their life story. But if you go to Genesis chapter 30, you'll find where we're going to start this whole thing. Now, if you remember our study last year, we looked at the life of Jacob. And you recall Jacob produced a rather unusual family. His love at first sight bride was Rachel, and yet he actually ended up marrying Rachel's sister first, unintentionally, through deception of his father-in-law. And it's quite a story there that you're going to have to go back and read if you weren't with us during that Jacob series. But though Rachel was Jacob's first love, his true love, she couldn't bear children. And so, you know, the early pages of that story tell and that family tell about how Jacob ended up fathering 10 sons and a daughter with Leah, who was the older sister, with Rachel's handmaid, and then with Leah's handmaid. And then finally, you read these words in Genesis chapter 30 and verse 22. It says, "Then God remembered Rachel. He listened to her and enabled her to conceive. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son and said, 'God has taken away my disgrace.' And she named him Joseph." And with that, Joseph entered this world. He had 10 older brothers and an older sister. Think about that clan. Together, this whole group would go through an awful lot of things in the next few years. First, they left where they were living with Uncle Laban and headed back to the Promised Land. And they did that kind of on the sly because Jacob didn't really want Laban to know he was leaving. So there was that transition, and that was traumatic enough. But over the next few years, quite a few more significant and trauma-filled things took place. There was the feared confrontation with Uncle Esau, promised to kill Jacob when he left town 20 years earlier. Then Dinah, the one sister in this whole group, was raped in Shechem, and her older brothers took it on themselves to avenge her honor and massacred that entire city. And how old Joseph was when all that transpired, we don't really know. How much he saw or understood is uncertain. And then, one of the most traumatic things that can happen to a young person happened when Joseph's mom, Rachel, died giving birth to his little brother, Benjamin. That impacted Joseph. It made him cherish his little brother, but it also led to his father making some unhealthy choices. And those show up in the chapter that I want to really focus on with you this morning. And that's Genesis chapter 37. So if you've got a Bible or you've got the Bible app on your phone, if you would find Genesis 37, verses 1 down through 11, we're going to expand our look at Joseph's messy early years in that chapter. Though the majority of Genesis chapter 37 through 50 deals with the life and the experiences of Joseph, Moses introduces this section, as you will see, as the account of Jacob's family line. And that's important. God inspired it that way to make the point that this was about more than just Joseph. It was about the entire family of Jacob with all of their warts and with all their flaws. And so let's dig into it. If you follow along with me, Genesis chapter 37, we'll just read the first few verses. It says this: "Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made an ornate robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Now, if we're going to put some captions over the messy years of Joseph's early life, sure, there was that early childhood trauma, but you've got to put this title in there of rough-edged relationships. You really cannot fully understand the life of Joseph without seeing that all around him were rough-edged relationships with his brothers. Now, last verse that I read there, it said that these 10 older brothers, they hated him. That's a strong word. They hated him and they could not even speak a kind word to him. That's the level of disruption that ran deep into this family. It seems to have started because Joseph turned in some kind of bad report about his brothers. Now, there are all kinds of ways to spin that. Joseph was in the family business. They were shepherds. They took care of livestock. And at some point, because of some incident, and like I said, we don't know details, Joseph decided to turn in a bad report about the others to his dad. And whether it was justified or not, or even, you know, what the details were that brought about the, hey, I'm going to go tell dad incident, it got the ball of hatred rolling. It was significant enough that it inspired these brothers to just have a deep-seated hatred for their brother. And it created this massively rough-edged relationship context for Joseph with his siblings. Now, I'm not going to, you know, take sides because, like I said, we don't even have any detailed information there. But I find it kind of interesting that even as a young boy, Joseph had the tendency already to notice the wrongs of others. I think we all kind of gravitate toward that, don't we? We have a tough time. We have a tough time noticing the wrongs in ourselves, but we're all kind of good at noticing the wrongs in others instead of giving them the benefit of the doubt. I just finished a book by Kyle Edelman called The End of Me, and he told a little story, and I'm sure all of you can relate to this one. He said this. This was Kyle's words. He said, last week I was driving my kids to school. My 9-year-old son asked me a good one. Dad, he said, why do you always talk to the other drivers? You know they can't hear you. But of course, he could. And I thought about the things he could hear me saying. What he didn't hear was a dad speaking words of life and encouragement to the community of fellow travelers. A dad taking responsibility or apologizing for his own bad moves behind the wheel. It's always the other guy, or gal, as is often the case. Kyle said, see what I'm doing here? Besides digging myself a hole, I'm pointing out that it's someone else's problem, not mine, and not even my gender. We can see it in other people, and we know what they should do differently, but we have a hard time recognizing it in ourselves. What my son did hear was a dad who was confident of his own righteous driving and looked down on the driving of others, a Pharisee of sorts, on wheels. My windshield magnifies the highway hijinks of others. I have big windows on every side of the car, and they show every vehicle out there but my own. I have a tiny mirror that shows only me. I love that picture because it's a rather accurate assessment, if we're honest, of the way we all tend to operate, the way we all tend to live. We see others, we notice others doing something that we don't agree with or we think is wrong or we have an opinion about. We assume the worst about their intentions, about their motives. But for us, we don't look too close. We got a very small mirror to see ourselves. But that leads somewhere. If that's the way you operate, if that's the way you live all the time, especially in your closest relationships, if that's the way you operate, it leads somewhere. It did for Joseph. And it often does for all of us. It leads to ragged-edged relationships. For Joseph, that would come back to bite him before very long. And yet, you know, Joseph was just a kid at this point. And if anyone needs to be given some slack, it's children that are still learning and growing and maturing. But Jacob, he was a grown-up. He was the father of this clan. And for him, it's a different story. And the verses that we just read there highlight that dad stepping into this ragged edge relationship context, instead of being the leader, tossed gasoline on the fire. Back to verse 3, it says, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he'd been born to him in his old age, and he made an ornate robe for him." Number 3 there in this caption is of Joseph's messy early years includes that coat of many colors. God had changed Jacob's name to Israel, as he's identified there, at that wrestling match by the Jabbok Creek. He was a different man than he had been in his early years, but he made a fundamental error here as a parent. And worse, it was something that he should have known would be a mistake and was a mistake. He should have known that from his own upbringing, from his own growing up years. Jacob and his twin brother Esau, they were scrapping with each other before they even took their first breath. In their mother's womb, they were fighting. And that tension intensified as they grew, but it was exploded because their parents decided to take favorites. Isaac loved Esau, they loved the same things, and Esau was dad's favorite. Rebekah loved Jacob, and she was the one who cherished him and put him first. It was very obvious that Jacob's parents played favorites, and it split that family into a rift that lasted for 20 years. Jacob didn't even get to say goodbye to his own mother for the last time because of it. Jacob had seen it firsthand, and you would think that that would mean that when he was in the trenches of raising a family, he would refuse to make that same mistake. But here he is, doing the exact same thing. He loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, and he made an ornate robe for him. Now, the Hebrew words there don't say anything about color, but every flannel graph I ever saw growing up showed a bunch of stripes and multicolors on Joseph's robe. The word that's described there for Joseph's robe, or Joseph's coat, is describing it as a very, very expensive garment, normally one that would only be worn by someone who was of nobility. In that culture, it would have been a long-sleeved tunic that probably flowed to the ground, which, if you think about it, is a little bit impractical for a shepherding outfit. You know, one of the writers that I read this week said, "In Joseph's day, the working garb was a short, sleeveless tunic. Giving Joseph that garment was like sending a welder to a construction site with a full-fledged, full-length mink coat." Joseph was being set apart. Jacob was setting Joseph apart from his brothers through this gift, boldly sort of implying, "Joseph, you're special, you're better, you don't have to worry about manual labor, like your brothers do." And whether it was reflected in Joseph's attitude or whether it was just dad's promotion, the message came through loud and clear to those 10 brothers. He thinks he's better than us. Dad thinks he's better than us. And as we read at the very end there, not surprisingly, they hated him for it. Now, that's where we stop reading verse 4. I want to pick up the story and see what happens next in verse 5. It says, verse 5, Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he said. Caption this last one, dreams probably better kept to yourself. Dreams in the ancient world were sometimes a means through which God revealed his plan to individual people. Today we have the completed revelation of God in the scriptures. And so we shouldn't read much into our dreams, but in the Old Testament especially, God communicated occasionally through a dream. And Joseph had two of them in this chapter. This first one was about sheaves of grain. He saw himself and his brothers out binding up sheaves of grain, as they harvested the grain to provide for their flocks and whatnot. And suddenly his sheaf of grain stood upright, and the others, they all intentionally bowed down to his. Now, you know, dreams are kind of weird, and having a dream is one thing, and Joseph having that dream, you know, that's certainly outside his doing, but telling that dream to other people is a different story, and specifically telling that dream to your 11 brothers was not a wise choice on Joseph's part. But here he is, right? Over breakfast the next morning, he spilled the story about the bowing down sheaves. And the result is unsurprising. At the beginning, at the end of that little section I read, it says, his brothers hated him all the more. The animosity, the hatred is running deeper and deeper in those relationships. Those guys knew, you know, what those dreams were suggesting. Their interpretation is pretty clear. You know, are you saying that one day we're going to bow down to you, that you're going to be the ruler over us? For them, frankly, that was unthinkable and totally unacceptable. But if you know the story of Joseph even slightly, you realize that God was giving Joseph this glimpse of his future and their future. God had it all mapped out, and that is exactly what would happen one day. But getting there would involve a lot more than Joseph or the others could have ever dreamed. That's dream one. We stopped in verse 8, go to verse 9, and it says this. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. Listen, he said, I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. When he told his father, as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. You know, same song, second verse. The exact same dream, just in a different format. This dream was about the sun and the moon and the 11 stars, interestingly, 11, right? Bowing down to him. And this time, Dad got it. You know, Dad stepped in with the interpretation and rebuked his son for suggesting that he and his mother, his 11 brothers, were somehow going to bow down to him. It does seem rather odd to include Mom in that, because Mom had already died. But the point was really clear. These two dreams together suggested that Joseph would have prominence over his entire family. And even Dad found that a little bit offensive. But he kept it tucked away in his mind. The brothers, on the other hand, though, they were, last phrase there, they were engulfed with jealousy. His brothers were jealous of him. Now, to me, that is a kind of interesting twist. You expect to read what we've read over and over and over and over again in this chapter already, that they hated him all the more. They hated him all the more. They hated him all the more. You expect to find that again. But instead, the last mention is they were engulfed with jealousy. Now, the Hebrew word behind that is the same thing as what you'd expect in English. The way we would define jealousy, it refers to an intense, strong emotion of wanting for yourself what someone else possesses. And to me, that's quite intriguing. You know, if given the opportunity, any one of them would have switched places with Joseph. As much as they hated him, they wanted what he had. They craved their father's special attention like Joseph enjoyed. They craved his apparent destiny being outlined by God as a ruler over the family and a success and being a future leader. They wanted that. And they wanted it so bad it poisoned them. It would lead them to do what seems totally reprehensible. But selfishness goes there. Selfishness and focusing only on us, it tends to lead in those in that direction. And these early years of Joseph's life, they were messy years. They were messy years. And it'll get worse before it gets better. But we're going to hit the pause button on the story this morning. And close with some lessons, because I think the early messy years of Joseph's life provide some early lessons that are valuable for us to think about. I came across a website recently that I found very cool. It shows by visualization where a raindrop, you know, theoretically, where a raindrop ends up depending on where it lands, anywhere in the country. And you can click on any location in the entire country, and if a raindrop lands in that town and that GPS point, you can follow where it will go and where it will eventually end up. And so, you know, of course, they started clicking around where we live, test this deal out. Rain that falls in Chase, here's a picture of the map there, rain that falls over in Chase, that goes into the Paray Marquette River and hits Lake Michigan around Manistee. Obviously, you probably guessed this one, rain that will land here in the city of Everett, it most likely ends up, you know, after following some creeks there, it ends up in the Muskegon River, and then 125 miles later, it launches out into Lake Michigan as well. But this last one is what I found most interesting. You don't have to travel very far east of here. And I couldn't specifically find an exact pivot point, but somewhere between Sears and Farwell, there's this dividing line. Well, rain that falls there goes east and finds its way, ends up not in Lake Michigan, but in Lake Huron, the exact opposite side of the state. Farwell is far enough that it shows the distinction. Rain that lands in Farwell ends up in Elm Creek, then the South Branch Tobacco River, eventually the Tittabawassee River, then the Saginaw River, finally Lake Huron. And that sounds complicated, but actually, a rain traveling from Farwell to Lake Huron is a shorter trip than a rain traveling from Everett to Lake Michigan. It's really interesting, and if you want, the website is on those pictures there if you want to play around with that. After you're done with the service here, you can go there and track that yourself. But think about that. You know, two raindrops falling not too far apart from each other along Route 10 head in completely opposite directions. And the takeaway from that little educational illustration there, is that where the raindrop lands has everything to do with where it goes. And another way to word it, maybe where it starts, its journey here on ground, where it starts, has everything to do with where it will end. And I share that because it is often the same way in life. How a child starts, the decisions that his or her parents make, for good or for bad, that points that child in a direction. That has everything to do with the direction that they'll head. The influences allowed in during those early formative years point in a direction. And one reason why I stress so much about the importance of kids ministry and talk a lot about the role of parents is because of this fact, this reality, that the early years are so important in shaping the future destiny of every single child. And parenting is a crucial piece in the direction of every single child's future. And so, you know, my early lessons from an impressive life, they start with this first one, that the choices we make as parents bear fruit in the lives of our children. Regularly bringing that to mind as you make life-shaping decisions is a big thing to do. The fractured relationship that Jacob had with his brothers, it should have, his own brother Esau, you know, I'm thinking of dad, that fractured relationship, that should have warned him. That should have told him that it was not a good idea to play favorites with your kids. But it didn't. He missed it. He forgot it. It totally slipped him. He made intentional choices to cherish Joseph and later Benjamin, the two boys that were born to his beloved Rachel. You know, he made intentional choices to cherish them over, to love them instead of or greater than all of his other sons. And those choices bore fruit. And it would eventually break his heart. And as parents, I think this is just so important to remember that the choices that you make as your children grow bear fruit in their lives in the future. And I get it, you know, our children are all grown and off raising families and living their lives. But I get it. I realize that on a busy Monday morning when you're trying to get everyone ready for the day, you don't have time to think about the decisions that you're making and the impact that it can have, you know, just on the fly. But slowing down once in a while and pausing to just sort of look at what kind of priorities do we hold as a family? What kind of decisions are we making as a family? That's valuable, because when you stop to think about the decisions you make that shape the priorities that you hold, that lead to the life habits that you make, that has a lot to do with the direction you're going, your family's going, and what kind of fruit is going to be born in the lives of your children down the road. We got to stop every once in a while and think about, you know, where am I really heading? Where is our family really heading? Where did the decisions and the life habits that I'm holding, where is that pointing? And is that direction where I want my kids to end up? Taking the time to do that now, evaluating that now, is so important, because 20 years from now, you can't go back and change it because you don't like the outcome of what's happened in your life or in your children's lives. But you can change it today. And so that's a really, really important takeaway. Take some time, if you're a parent, to think about the choices that you're making, because the choices that you make as a parent bear fruit in the lives of your kids. Now, here's a second truth, an early lesson from our early messy years in Joseph's life. God knows what he's going to accomplish in your life long before you have any idea, before you have any hint of it. Getting there may require detours and valleys, but trust him and keep moving forward. God knows what he's doing in your life. The other side of this part of Joseph's biography is that even though he grew up in this crazy, disjointed family, stained by favoritism and hatred, God still had this enormous plan for Joseph's life, and he gave him this glimpse of it right at the start. You may have had a less than ideal upbringing. You may have thought, you know, you're the only one with a dysfunctional family. I think it's kind of funny how most people think that their upbringing was uniquely difficult. We're all sinners, and since we're all sinners, every one of us have some screwed up things in our past. But you know what? God is not limited by your past. God can, in fact, uniquely position you for a life of impact because of some of those hard things that you've endured in your past. God knew what he was going to do in Joseph's life. He gave him this glimpse of it when he was just a boy. And that might have intended, you know, by God to be a little glimmer, a source of hope when life got hard, because it did for Joseph. It got really, really hard, and we'll see that starting next week. But God was taking him somewhere. God is always taking us somewhere. God is always up to something in our lives. He had a plan for his life, and he's got a plan for your life. The key is, do I decide to trust him in that? Do I choose to obey him and keep moving forward with him, even when detours happen and dark valleys arise and it feels too messy right now? Do I trust God? God knows what he's going to accomplish in your life long before you have a hint. So make that choice. Make that choice to be a person of faith. And then I've got one last one. Something just to think about here. Guard against the infection of jealousy in your heart, because wanting something more than wanting to please God can lead to things you never imagined you would consider. I kind of hesitated whether to tack on this last one, but it sort of stands out at the end there as this unexpected problem in the hearts of the brothers. You know, it'd be more assumed, more expected to read, you know, they hated him, they despised him. They were ready to do evil things towards him. But instead it says they wanted what he had. They were jealous of him. And it seems so unexpected. And it's probably something that's somewhat unexpected, often unnoticed in our own heart. Jealousy is not just about wanting a bigger boat or a faster car or a nicer house. Jealousy attaches to anything. Relationships, success, a sense of meaningful living. We can want some very good things too much. And I think a good clarifier is this, that if you want something, anything, not just a possession, but like they did, desiring what their brother had in that relationship with their father, if you want something, more than you want to please God in the way you respond to your life, then that thing has taken the place of God in your heart. And that's a dangerous place to be. That's a spiritually hazardous place to be. It can open you up to doing things you never imagined you might do. And so the last challenge here, the last early lesson from a messy early year is to watch for that. Push back on that. Don't let anything become bigger in your desire structure than your desire to please God. Joseph lived an epic life, but it wasn't an easy life. It was not an easy life at all, and we'll see that soon enough. He had hard years. It took a lot out of him. But Joseph moved forward. He moved forward from the mess of his childhood with his faith anchored in God, that those dreams that God gave him as a boy would one day come true. And I don't know. I don't know what your life is like. I don't know what type of mess you have in your past, or maybe that you'd say is a part of your present right now. But I do know that God specializes in saving messy people. Jesus came here to save sinners. Paul said he was the chief of those, but we all qualify. God specializes in saving messy people. I hope that you have a relationship with him. If you're not sure that you do, I hope that you'll reach out to us and drop a note, an email to us at the church. We'd love to talk to you about how you can know God yourself by putting your faith in Jesus Christ. But if you do, I want to encourage you as we start this series and sort of think about what Joseph went through and how he grew to be a man who trusted God in dark days and forgave, even when that seemed impossible. I want to just remind you that no matter how messy your past, no matter how messy it feels right now, you too can trust God. You too can grow through this. And in fact, making that decision to trust, obey, and keep moving with God is the very best step, the very best step to take forward. And that's our opening page. Come back next week, and we're going to look at the rest of this chapter. But let's close our time together in a word of prayer. Father God, thank you so much for including in the pages of Scripture so many accounts of the lives of people that went through things that help us understand you, help us understand how to navigate our own lives and sometimes our own messes. And Joseph is one of the most powerful examples, and I thank you that we get to look at that and look closer into his biography this summer. Guide through that. But help us this week to take away the things that we need. Maybe those that are in the trenches of raising little kids, raising teenagers. Hey, they need the reminder. They need this reminder from Joseph's story that decisions made today affect the outcome of our children's lives in the future. And so I pray that each parent would really look close at that and think closely about that. Now, Lord, all of us need to grow a little bit at trusting you and responding to our lives the best way. And Lord, you know the things that everyone's going through, the things that people are facing this week that maybe are a bit of a mess. I pray you'll help all of us to take from Joseph's life this direct challenge to be people that say, you know what, I'm going to trust God. I'm going to push back on the things that I want, that I crave, that compete with him, and I'm just going to trust God. I'm going to obey God. I'm going to follow God and wait and see what God has planned for my life. If we do that, if we make that choice, Lord, only you know the things that you have planned and the good that you're going to bring through bad, even in our experience. So guide us this week. Help us to be Josephs, walking away from messy lives with a strong faith in our powerful God. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Hey, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Got some announcement slides they're going to show. Just hope you have a really great week, and we'll see you again next Sunday.